Blog Talk Radio.
Strengthen your
European biotech voices. While the leaked thought political agenda behind Monsanto are GMO crops, the ambassador plainly calls for target retaliation against nations who are against using Monsanto's genetically modified corn, admittedly linked to organ damage and environmental devastation. Amazingly, this is not an isolated case. In similar newly released cables, United States diplomats are found to have pushed GMO crops as a strategic government and commercial imperative. Furthermore, the U.S. specifically targeted advisors to the Pope due to the fact that many Catholic bishops and figureheads are openly denounced for GMO crops. In fact, the Vatican has openly declared Monsanto GMO crops as a new form of slavery.
Well, they finally stood up to something, huh?
Yeah, amazing. A Martino deputy told us recently that the Cardinal had cooperated with Embassy Vatican on biotech over the past 3 years, in part to compensate for his vocal disapproval of the Iraq War and its aftermath, to keep relations with the U.S. government smooth. And according to our source, Martino no longer feels the need to make this approach that was released. And perhaps the most shocking piece of information exposed by the cable is the fact that these U.S. diplomats are actually working directly for biotech corporations like Monsanto. And the cables also highlight the relationship between the U.S. and Spain and their conquest to persuade other nations to allow for the expansion of GMO crops. Not only did the Spanish government secretly correspond with the U.S. government on the subject, but the U.S. government actually knew beforehand how Spain would vote before the Spanish Biotech Commission reported their decision regarding GMO crops. And this cable states, In response to recent urgent requests by Spanish Rural Affairs Minister, State Secretary Joseph Puzo, and Monsanto, both requests renewed U.S. government support of Spain's science-based agriculture and biotechnology position through high-level U.S. government intervention. And Monsanto has undoubtedly infiltrated the U.S. government in order to push their health agenda, endangering agenda. And this has been known long before the release of these WikiLeaks cables. The U.S. is the only place where Monsanto's synthetic hormone, Poziliac, is still used in roughly one-third of all cows, with 27 nations banning the substance over legitimate health concerns. Despite Monsanto's best attempts at incognito political corruption, nothing can stop the grassroots anti-Monsanto movement that is taking over cities and nations. I was happy to read that.
So, horrible
isn't
company.
Isn't it horrible?
Company out of hell.
Yeah. It honestly is. And, and this one I'll gladly read. It's called Hungary Throws Out Monsanto and the IMF.
Well,
I love it.
Those are two groups from hell.
Yeah. Okay. Can you read that at all?
Second folks, the things that are following here. Oh, okay. I don't know about you, but I would label my personal knowledge of Hungary as wanting, if not painfully incomplete. It's not an easy country to come to grips with, not least of all, of course, because Hungarian doesn't look like any Western language we know, in the possible exception of Finnish. I did visit just after the wall came down and remember huge contrasts, almost paradoxes, between rural poverty and a capital, Budapest, that was much richer than other capitals such as Prague. A leftover of Budapest's status as a meeting place between Western and Eastern diplomats and businessmen. The riches were not for all, though. The city center was full of beggars and panhandlers, mostly Roma. To keep up the paradox, Mercedes sold more luxury models in Hungary than just about anywhere else back then, reportedly mostly also to Roma, just not the same. In the years since, precious little attention has been as being devoted to the former Eastern Bloc countries in the Anglo press. We know most of the countries are now members of the European Union, but only A few have been allowed to enter the hallowed grounds of the Eurozone. One thing I did pick up on last year was the news that Hungary's PM, Viktor Orban, had thrown chemical, food, and seed giant Monsanto out of the country, going as far as to plow under 1,000 acres of land. Now, I have little patience for Monsanto, infamous for many products ranging from Agent Orange to Roundup, nor for its ilk from DuPont and Syngenta, all former chemical companies that have at some point decided they could sell more chemicals than ever before by applying them on and inside everyone's daily food. Patenting nature itself seems either unworthy of mankind or its grandest achievement. I don't care much for either one. So Orban has my tentative support on this one.
This particular article he wrote back in
July 20, 2011,
but it stated that from International Business Times that Hungary destroys all Monsanto GMO maize fields and the U.S. to start trade wars. We just read that one, but this area you might want to read.
In an effort to rid the country of Monsanto's GMO products, Hungary has stepped up the pace. This looks like it's going to be another slap in the face for Monsanto. A new regulation was introduced this March which stipulates that seeds are supposed to be checked for GMO before they are introduced to the market. Unfortunately, some GMO seeds made it to the farmers without them knowing it. Almost 1,000 acres of maize found to have been grown with genetically modified seeds have been destroyed throughout Hungary, the Deputy State Secretary of the Ministry of Rural Development said. The GMO maize has been plowed under. Unlike several EU members, GMO seeds are banned in Hungary. The checks will continue despite the fact that the seed traders are obligated to make sure their products are GMO-free, Bogner said. During their investigation, controllers have found Pioneer and Monsanto products among the seeds planted. Let's see what else. Yeah, I'm looking for the thing on the IMF. The IMF and the EU, like the tandem team of Monsanto and Washington before them, act like schoolyard bullies. It's become their standard MO, and it usually works. Portraits of Orban as a fool, a reckless idiot, and a dangerous populist on par with that of Hugo Chavez or newly found international enemy Rafael Correa are much easier to find than those links to WikiLeaks Monsanto's cables. It would be good to see Orban continue to stand up to the IMF bullies, but he may not have that choice. They can simply financially bleed him dry like they have so many other countries and their leaders. It's a time-tested model, so maybe we'll have to do with a good and hearty chuckle and enjoy his announcement yesterday. Hungary's Prime Minister has long had a testy relationship with the International Monetary Fund, and on Thursday, he used Facebook to unfriend the agency and reject its allegedly tough loan conditions. Prime Minister Viktor Orban said in a video message on his official Facebook page that Hungary could not accept pension cuts, the elimination of a bank tax, fewer public employees, and other conditions in exchange for an IMF loan that other officials have said could be about $18.9 billion. The IMF's list of conditions, Orban said, contains everything that is not in Hungary's interest. Orban's announcement took the market by surprise, in part because just a day earlier, he had said that loan negotiations with the IMF and the European Union were going according to schedule, and both sides were willing to reach an agreement. In the late 2008, under a socialist government, Hungary became the first EU country to receive an IMF-led bailout. The Orban government, however, decided not to renew the loan agreement in 2010 so it could implement its economic policies without IMF control. But the increasing weakness of the Hungarian currency, and investors' growing loss of trust in the country's economy made the government abruptly change its mind late last year when it again sought the IMF help. Because what the IMF demands is what has always demanded through the years from countries it lends money to is to cut pensions, cut the public sector, cut benefits, yada yada, and then privatization, open markets, and an open financial system so international operating conglomerates can move in and divvy up the spoils, create, and this is in quote, a more business-friendly environment to boost growth. The IMF is the poster child for disaster capitalism. No matter how U.S. to twist and turn it, and Orban can see clearly what is being done in Greece, which is just around the corner from Hungary.
You know, the thing you got to remember is that, you know, the United States owns over 50% of the IMF. Okay? It controls the IMF, right? Even though it puts in European leaders and stuff, you know what I mean? It still owns over, and it owns the World Bank.
Yep.
So it's like, we are the ones that are screwing all these other countries.
Well, first they did it to us, and then they moved right around the world to do it to everybody else.
Yeah, sure.
We've had to suffer. Yeah.
And I guess Moody's today just downgraded or threatened to downgrade our.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what happened with that.
Yeah, because we hit $16 trillion in deficit. But, like I think Dick Cheney says, no, deficits don't matter.
Yeah, he said that a long time ago.
Sure, they don't matter. It's all makeup money.
It's all paper money anyway. It's not real. It's not like it's backed by anything.
Yeah, this is terrible.
Except it were the slaves to the bankers. That's what it's backed by.
If alcohol were discovered today, would it be legal?
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah. In the days following the publication of our arms paper, several newspapers ran headlines along the lines of Professor Nutt says alcohol is worse than drugs, as though alcohol weren't the drug itself. This false distinction is a large part of the communication problem I encounter whenever I try to emphasize how harmful alcohol is. It has a separate language. You get high on drugs, but drunk on alcohol. Drug addicts need a fix, and alcoholics need a drink. As I hope that this satirical paragraph about alcohol shows, methyl carbonyl is another chemical name for ethanol, which is the psychoactive part of alcohol. To think rationally about drugs policy, we have to see alcohol in the same context as other drugs, not separately. Alcohol also has a lot to teach us about what not to do with a potentially lethal habit-forming substance. What not to do when a potentially lethal habit-forming substance is lethal. We are currently facing a public health crisis of immense proportions. The increase in harms caused by alcohol over the last 50 years in the UK is comparable to the gin craze in the early 18th century, and the urban poor of London were consuming a pint of gin a day per head on the average.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. It's getting worse. This is by Altman.
Are they talking about drinking in this country or drinking in England? Or?
They were talking about England on that one, but this goes right to the it says we are currently facing a public health crisis of immense proportions and so on. Recent annual statistics: 40,000 deaths, include 350 just from acute alcohol poisoning, and 8,000 from cirrhosis to the liver. More than 1 million hospital admissions in 2007 and 2008. This is from an English.
Because we'd have far more than that.
We have much more.
We have much higher.
Much higher population and much more people. 7,000 road traffic accidents, include 500 deaths. 1.2 million violent incidents, 500,000 crimes.
So they have as much, have a big problem with alcohol as we do.
40% of domestic violence cases involve alcohol, as well as 50% of child protection cases.
Yeah.
3.5 million adults in the UK are addicted, and up to 700,000 children live with a parent with a drinking problem. 4,000 children a year are born with fetal alcohol syndrome each year. Now remember, they only have 40 million people in their country. We have 300 million. And the total economic cost has been calculated as
£30 billion.
£30 billion per year. Some calculation estimate as high as $55 billion.
No, £55 billion.
£55 billion pounds. I'm sorry. No, that's the drink industry proposed responded to critics by in mind by saying the alcohol misuse affects only a minority. Clearly, alcohol harms. I have a hard time reading that. That article. I don't know why.
Clearly, alcohol harms don't affect just a minority. They affect all of us. As victims of car crashes and street violence, as patients, as families of hazardous drinkers, and as taxpayers, reducing these harms and associated costs is a huge public health challenge that ought to be top priority for our policymakers. Unfortunately, while the Labor government was talking tough on drugs, trying to score political points by making cannabis Class B, banning methadone, and exaggerating the harms of ecstasy, they missed the growing epidemic around the most harmful drug of all, or more accurately, just looked the other way. So, you know, there's a lot of hype around substance abuse, but then they separate that from alcohol.
Yeah.
I don't think we do in this country. Alcohol is talked about a lot as a destroyer of families, and also the harms associated with domestic violence are always talked about in child abuse.
But it's never associated with drugs.
Yeah, it's a legal drug.
It's just a legal drug.
Like tobacco.
Right. But it's a legal drug. That kills everybody. And it kills all kinds of people.
Yeah.
All kinds of lives.
Not only does it do that, it not only kills people, but it kills them slowly in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah.
Because it makes them ill. It's an underlying problem in a lot of our health.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, they're promoting 2 drinks a day. You know,
mm-hmm.
Everybody should have 2 drinks a day for good health. Yeah.
Well, wine they're talking about.
No, absolutely. It's like 2 drinks a day.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, the problem is that people think, okay, 2 drinks is good. I'll have 5
well,
or 6.
Or, you know, 2 beers or 2 wines.
Oh, that gets a mixed review, though. You know, that's not always true.
Yeah, I just heard it again, last week on the network news.
Probably a study done by the liquor industry.
The liquor industry, yeah. And, you know, the absurdity of all that is just that it's, you know, this is, the reason I'm reading this is because it bothered me so much, because I see this, I've seen it ever since I was a kid, you know, and I grew up with it, but this is relating to all the industries, but how the drinks industry influences alcohol policy.
Oh, they buy off everybody.
Yeah.
Huge lobby.
Yeah. Going by the English way, they call it drinks industry, they call it the liquor industry. It's one of the most powerful industrial groups in the UK today. It spends huge sums of money on maintaining its privileged relationship with our lawmakers, just like they do here.
Uh-huh.
The same thing here.
Exactly.
Political lobbying takes place largely in secret. Even so, the Labour government 2004 alcohol harm reduction strategy shows clear evidence of the influence of drinks in the industry because it focused on the measures the industry had recommended, such as information campaigns and education, and ignored the measures recommended by the chief medical officer, such as minimum pricing. In fact, the House of Commons Health Committee itself commented on this in its 2009-2010 report on alcohol. We are concerned that government policies are much closer to and too influenced by those of the drinks industry and the supermarkets and those of expert health professionals such as the Royal College. And it goes on, but just to Consuming alcohol is normal, common, healthy, and very responsible. This is what the alcohol industry said.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is their marketing plan. Or this is what their, you know, the European Center for Monitoring Alcohol, right, recently published a report called The 7 Key Messages of Alcohol Industry, which summarizes the sort of messages the industry uses to try to influence alcohol policy. Again, consuming alcohol is normal, common, healthy, and very responsible. Two, the damage done by alcohol, that was only seven, by alcohol is caused by a small group of deviants who cannot handle alcohol.
This is what the alcohol industry is saying. That's ridiculous.
Normal adult non-drinkers do not, in fact, exist.
Do people believe this?
Ignore the fact that alcohol is a harmful and addictive chemical substance, ethanol, for the body. In fact, alcohol problems can only be solved when all parties work together. And six, alcohol marketing is not harmful. It's simply intended to assist the consumer in selecting a certain product or brand. And seven, education about responsible use is the best method to protect society from alcohol problems. Okay. I just find. And of course, the thing goes on and it breaks down the absurdity of the different
I think it might be a good idea if you chose some music, because there's something that I want to look for on there.
Okay.
When we come back. So why don't you...
This one was very good, too. I don't know if we... I have two articles on Israel I'd like to get. Please, listen. They forget Iran. Israel's nuclear gunpoint. Forget that the U.S. is Israel's special bond.
Yeah, that would be a good one, too.
I thought that was good. And then I wanted to read the one on the assassination.
Well, why don't we read this one, and then you can pick out some music. Yeah. Forget Iran. It's Israel's nuclear bond pointed at Obama's death. The myth of the U.S.-Israel special bond. Because there was one on Canada I wanted to read.
Oh, okay.
It's possible. The greatest of American political myths repeated ad nauseum by presidential candidates in their election campaigns. President Barack Obama has claimed that the United States enjoys a special bond with Israel, unlike its relations with any other country. He has called the friendship unshakable, enduring, and unique, anchored by our common interests and deeply held values. I don't have anything in common with Israel. His Republican rival Mitt Romney has gone further, arguing that there is not an inch of difference between ourselves and our ally Israel. Oh, really? A recent Romney election ad highlighted his summer visit to Israel, and he extolled the deep and cherished relationship. But while such pronouncements form the basis of an apparent Washington consensus, the reality is that the cherished friendship is no more than a fairy tale. Has been propagated by politicians to mask the suspicion and plentiful examples of duplicity and betrayal that have marked the relationship since Israel's founding. Politicians may prefer to express undying love of Israel and hand over billions of dollars annually in aid, but the U.S. security establishment has, at least in private, always regarded Israel as an unfaithful partner. Distrust has been particularly hard to hide in relation to Iran. Israel has been putting relentless pressure on Washington, apparently in the hope of maneuvering it into supporting or joining an attack on Tehran, to stop what Israel claims is an Iranian effort to build a nuclear bomb concealed beneath its civilian energy program. While coverage has focused on the personal animosity between Obama and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the truth is that U.S. officials generally are deeply at odds with Israel on this issue. The conflict burst into the open this month with reports that the Pentagon had scaled back next month's joint military exercise, austere challenge with the Israeli military that has been billed as the largest and most significant in the two countries' history. The goal of the exercise was to test the readiness of Israel's missile defense shield in case of Iranian reprisal, possibly the biggest fear holding Israel back from launching a go-it-alone attack. The Pentagon's main leverage on Israel is its X-band radar stationed in Israel, but operated exclusively by a U.S. crew that would provide Israel with early warning of Iranian missiles. A senior Israeli military official told Time magazine what the message the Pentagon's rethink had conveyed. Basically, what the Americans are saying is, we don't trust you.
Yeah, right, we don't.
But the discord between the two unshakable allies is not limited to Iran. Antipathy has been the norm for decades. Over the summer, current and former CIA officials admitted that the U.S. security establishment has always regarded Israel as its number one counterintelligence threat in the Middle East. The most infamous spy working on Israel's behalf was Jonathan Pollard, a naval intelligence officer who passed thousands of classified documents to Israel in the 80s. Israel's repeated requests for his release have been a running score with the Pentagon, not least because defense officials regard promises that Israel would never again operate spies on the U.S. soil as insincere. At least two more spies have been identified in the past few years. In 2008, a former U.S. Army engineer, Ben Amami Kadesh, admitted that he had allowed Israeli agents to photograph secret documents about U.S. fighter jets and nuclear weapons in the 80s. And in 2006, Lawrence Franklin, a U.S. defense official, was convicted of passing classified documents to Israel concerning Iran. In fact, such betrayals were assumed by Washington from the start of the relationship. In Israel's early years, the U.S. base in Cyprus monitored Israel's activities. Today, Israeli communications are intercepted by a team of Hebrew linguists stationed at Fort Meade, Maryland. Documents released this month by the Israeli Air Force archives also reveal that Israel eventually identified mysterious high-altitude planes that overflew its territory through the 50s as American U-2 espionage planes. In a sign of continuing U.S. caution, Israel has not been included in the coterie of countries with which Washington shares sensitive intelligence. The member of the Five Eyes group consists of U.S., Britain, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand have promised not to spy on each other, condition Israel would have regularly flouted were it a member. Indeed, Israel has even stolen the identities of nationals from these countries to assist in Mossad operations. Most notoriously, Israel forged passports to smuggle Israeli agents into Dubai in 2010 to assassinate Hamas leader Mohamed al-Mabhouh. Israel's far from a trusted ally of the U.S. war on terror. A former intelligence official told the Associated Press in July that Israel ranked lower in Libya in a list of countries helping to fight terrorism compiled by the Bush administration after September 11th. So why all the talk of a special bond and relationship when it's really characterized by such deep mistrust? Part of the answer lies in the formidable, intimidating tactics of the pro-Israel lobby in Washington. Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist, spoke for a growing number of observers last year when he wrote that the U.S. Congress was effectively bought and paid for by Israel's lobbyists. That power was all too evident last week when the Democratic National Convention adopted an amended policy designating Jerusalem as Israel's capital, in opposition to both international law and the vocal wishes of delegates. But there is another, less spoken of reason. Francis Perrin, the head of the French Atomic Agency in the 50s and 60s, when France was helping Israel develop a nuclear weapon against the wishes of the U.S., once observed that the Israeli bomb was really aimed against the Americans, not because Israel wanted to attack U.S., because it realized that once it had possessed the only nuclear arsenal in the Middle East, the U.S. would really risk standing in its way. However, much of its policies run counter to U.S. interests. For that reason, if no other, Israel is determined to stop any rival, including Iran, from getting a nuclear weapon that would end its monopoly.
Interesting.
That's a thought. I never really thought about that.
I always wondered how they could stand behind them so
vociferous.
Yeah, exactly. When in reality, they, you know, they're bastards.
And there isn't anything that they do that really is in our own interest.
Not at all. In fact, it's you know, there's a lot
counter
of evidence
the
that they might have been, they were highly involved in 9/11. You know, so it's just amazing.
Okay, let's go to a music break.
Yeah, and then I want to come back and read this one on the news.
Yeah, we can do that.
Israel assassination attempt on General Dempsey in Afghanistan. So we'll be right back, folks.
Suspicion with which
we do not have to deal. There are those close to President Obama who don't accept the attacks on Dempsey at face value, with a public admission by the Taliban of complicity. Such statements would certainly cause alien reprisals by the U.S. and are often found on internal sites lacking credible connection to any Islamic source. To some Americans, the attack appears to be a reprisal against Dempsey, who out of coincidence cited the motive in his own appraisal of Israel's judgment, their constant suspicion. News agencies buried the Thiel attack, knowing Dempsey is hated by Netanyahu and respected by the Taliban as both truthful and fair. Netanyahu longs for the days when General Myers held Dempsey's job under Bush 43, both flawed and narcissistic, predictable puppets, the perfect fodder for Netanyahu's machinations. Only 2 weeks ago, presidential hopeful Mitt Romney returned from a trip overseas, coming back to America with $60 million collected in Israel and Britain, while accompanied by casino boss Sheldon Adelson, whose Las Vegas and China organizations have long been reputed to be the center of worldwide organized crime. That's disgusting, isn't it?
Yeah.
The business, gambling, drugs, prostitution, and money laundering, and now war, is seeking its own president, and war on Iran is the only issue driving the American campaign. Romney, as a state governor, was, if anything, to the left of President Obama. Romney's support of government health care and widespread gun control was totally opposite to the core constituency of the Republican Party, the weapons lobby, and medical racketeers. Romney has found, however, that though it is illegal for any American candidate to accept monies overseas, while overseas from overseas, at home from those who are citizens of other countries, he feels himself above the law in the sweet and motherly arms of the Israeli-controlled American media. Now drowning in illegal cash, much from London bankers, his most interesting catch was the private dinner he shared with Tel Aviv's blood diamond smugglers, who donated up to $25 million in one night. Oh, this makes me sick.
Yeah.
Oh, he's just a crook. Key to his financial success is his lifelong history of working closely with organized crime. His investment company, Bain, was funded initially by a cash infusion from El Salvador death squads many years ago. These investors are still at his side despite charges of mass murder and corruption. Bain Capital is Romney's money laundering and tax avoidance company with thousands of secret bank accounts and safe havens around the world, invisible billions, hidden transactions, unseen profits, and unseen clients. Now Romney has found the mother of all causes, selling the promise of an American war fought by Americans, financed by Americans, American debt, American blood, America collapse, a war demanded by not Jews of the world, but by organized crime groups operating throughout Israel's Lucidus Party, dominated by the Koch brothers, American gasoline speculators, Sheldon Adelson, whose reputation would fill volumes, and Rupert Murdoch, whose spy organization is now proved to have blackmailed three consecutive British governments, while proven and likely to have even been more successful in the United States, Germany, Canada, and Australia, and dozens of other nations. Most embarrassing to both Russia and the United States has been the ability of organized criminal organizations to secure sanctions against Iran when both nations are burdened by official reports stating with comprehensive clarity that Iran has no nuclear program. Even more embarrassing for Russia, who refused to veto sanctions as they did with Iran's ally Syria, is the fact that Iran's peaceful nuclear program is built in near entirety on Russian technology, a Russian nuclear reactor, and 3,000 Russian technicians. Statements by Obama directly contradict America's national intelligence estimates. The estimates stated that Iran has no nuclear program. Russia's Putin has similarly ignored not just his own intelligence agencies, but the fact that Russia is actually building Iran's reactor and has 3,000 technicians in Iran, all of whom probably are not entirely deaf and dead or blind. Obama has no rational claim to ignorance. His behavior is like that of on the playground. All the other children are eating dirt. He feels he has to do the same. In this case, however, when known false is likely to end in a destructive war, are agreed to out of fear of retaliation by a former furniture salesman, that's Netanyahu, or gambling boss, the real importance of this presidency comes into doubt. A problem no one will mention is the behavior of Putin in Tel Aviv. Back in Netanyahu's claims of Iran's violation of voluntary agreements based on no other facts than the statements of one of the world's best-known pathological liars, what does the failed furniture salesman from Philadelphia have on Uncle Vladimir? Neither leader has dealt with the simple fact. Iran has the right to build anything it wants for any reason it wants. Similarly, the United States under Bush both withdrew from the anti-ballistic missile treaty of 1972 and withdrew from participation in the International Criminal Court at The Hague. The latter, the withdrawal from the court, is a veritable admission of complicity in war crimes with key U.S. officials facing indictment and arrest around the globe. Well, one, to be honest, the entire British administration is under a privileged form of house arrest, as is Britain's Tony Blair. All face criminal proceedings and continually make plans to travel, but end up canceling, sometimes out of public outcry for justice, or to actually avoid being arrested. Despite his pronouncements, even with an election coming up and the need to parrot childish threats in order to please the Israeli press, a prerequisite, Obama has made it clear he will not attack Iran. It's time the public realizes that by opposing war and running against Romney, an agent of a hostile foreign power and a long-time organized crime affiliate, the president and those around him are at great risk. The carefully choreographed and very public attempt on the life of General Dempsey is a greeting card from the Adelson, Romney, Netanyahu camp. Several appropriate responses, RSVPs there were, come to mind, some partially fatal. Is an American president really the leader of the free world, as we often say, if any too big thug can dictate policy? Do you want to read? Despite
that position, Obama controls well over 80% of the Jewish vote in the United States, whereas appointed as pointed out in an earlier article, studies have shown only 4% of Jewish voters in America feel Iran is any threat to Israel. A critical part of understanding organized crime requires the studies of its origins, particularly in America during the 19th century. While London, from the earliest days of what America had believed to be freedom from British rule, ran America's economy and was itself subjected to the rule by continental bankers. Britain, the colonizer of the world, was itself no more than a client of the Bauer Rothschild group who underwrote the British pound. And the real criminal groups running American politics developed from among the immigrant gangs that settled American cities. There were German, Irish, Italian, and Jewish gangs. All that survive now are the remnants of the mafia. The Jewish gangs who now run Washington and Wall Street, and the new threats from Kosovo in Albania, and the latest round of criminal immigration into America. With the full cooperation, this article is a little bit long here, but...
So what they're telling us basically is the criminals are running the world.
Yeah, and they're saying that with full cooperation, the FBI, Director Hoover, tasked with protecting America from criminal organizations, the government stood aside while every aspect of American life, every necessity from water to electricity to medicine, leaving nothing out, came under assault by criminal groups growing fat on profiteering from war, narcotics, and during the prohibition years, the sale of illegal alcohol. And for decades, the Americas, you think, I just thought of Joe Kennedy there.
Yeah.
For decades, America's media has been tasked with blaming all the Brazils on Italian immigrants and corrupt trade unions under a well America has done little but a colony of key European banking families who created wars, suppressed technologies, manipulated currencies, raised and crushed stock markets and national economies, and in the end became as a hydra, the multi-headed beast of Greek mythology, ruling all. And what drew Adelson, Romney, and even Putin to Israel at this critical time as the world sits on the brink of nuclear war over Syria is simple. We are again reminded of Putin's visit to Israel. No Israeli citizen was spoken to. No public concerns were addressed. And no, a visit to Israel is a visit to the safe haven for worldwide organized crime that controls and manages the vast and endless wealth of the Russian continent as easily as it runs Britain or dances its Washingtonian puppets into discarding laws and traditions and becoming a surrogate bully for a nation, for an international crime conspiracy. The language of politics must be replaced with the language of crime as the solutions to what are misconstrued as political power moves are and have long been responses to the depredations of criminal organizations. It isn't as though Iran were the only target, simply the public target where control of the United Nations Council can be exercised, a demonstration of raw power of evil. The mistake made by so many is to use principles of geopolitics to describe the world condition, the conditional entropy, the centralization of wealth, and the rapid deterioration of human rights as war rage without end. And even the educated classes, searching for patterns and rationales to explain a $2,000 trillion represented by the derivative debt, could encumber all the world's currencies, a staggering amount created by an unseen hand through a process none have yet been able to describe. Debt, $2,000 trillion. And debt, or as it is known in criminal circles as loan sharking, is the business of the world. And controlling currencies was not enough. Thus controlled governments, bribed, threatened, blackmailed, and bought, looked away while the wealth and the hope of 100 generations was stolen outright. And a new line of text, a new entries of computers, and a few entries of computers and generations of our progeny are changed. In that event, or in that moment, the citizens of the world, the useless eaters, as Henry Kissinger would describe them. And armies may march, air forces may bomb, and drones may attack, but none of this is war or politics, nor has it been for centuries. This is where we went awry. We chose to play chess while our opponents simply put a pistol on the table and emptied our pockets. America is living this today as it looks on an upcoming election. If very few can escape the package news script in Hollywood or Washington or Tel Aviv, and our political life is this theatrical production, comic tragedy without a Shakespearean irony. This is the government that Sheldon Adelson, the man who believes he will be America's next president, believes he can take to war, a systematic conquest of the Middle East and Central Asia, done for the criminal elements from some call Israel, done quite simply to prove the power of evil over good. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Very scary stuff.
Yeah. I like this particular website. It's 12160. I like it very much because what they did is they took my video, or they put my show on Garudas, the two programs I did, and they put a video to it and then they put it on their site.
Well, that was great. They thought it was worthwhile.
Yeah, and so I appreciate that. We talked about the assault on General Dempsey there. Okay. And which one did you just do? We talked about that one, but it wasn't this one.
I didn't see the next one you did.
The one I wanted was this one.
We just did that one.
That's the one we did. Okay. So,
I wanted to read it on Canada.
Oh, you want to read that one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I just wanted to mention quickly the one on gardening companies faces $12.5 million penalty for adding poison to bird food. And that company is Scott's Miracle-Gro.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
U.S. lawn gardening company Scott's Miracle-Gro, world's largest market of residential pesticides, is facing $12.5 million in fines for violating numerous federal pesticide laws and for adding illegal toxins to wild bird food.
Okay.
What are crazy people? The company pleaded guilty to distributing pesticides with leading and unapproved labels, distributing unregistered pesticides, and falsifying pesticide registration. Most disturbing was that it used use of toxic insecticide in its bird food products, including Storicide 2 and Axalate 5.
There was a woman, Canada, is becoming a very conservative country. I mean, we always thought of Canada as being more liberal than we are, but they've taken a severe turn to the right, and they've lost a lot of their freedoms that they had.
Well, I can't look at that.
It's on the first page.
Yeah, I did want to mention the rise in food prices.
Well, that's okay. You can go to that if you can't find it.
Yeah.
But I thought that was kind of interesting. Did you happen to read that article?
Which one?
The one on Canada.
I browsed through it. I saw that it was, though.
Kind of an interesting thing. That was a surprise to me. I haven't paid very much
attention. Well, they're turning. They just dropped their relationship with Iran because of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to say that Israel is dead. That's why you can. Here, why don't you read this one?
We just have a couple of minutes. I just have a couple of minutes. I'll read this. Rising food prices continue to climb with prices up 10% in July alone. Food prices, this is by Lisa Garber of the Activist Post. Food prices are rising and consumers are feeling it. Rising food prices aren't only hitting America. They are happening all over the world. Costs have gone up 10% between June and July alone, with corn, soybeans, and wheat reaching record prices. This outpaces the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization's estimate of 6% increase. While we may all see small changes in the grocery store and our grocery bills, World Bank President Jim Yong Kim says countries reliant on imported grains, especially Africa and the Middle East, are particularly vulnerable. The World Bank attributes the price jump mainly to the American heat wave and drought in Eastern Europe, which has hurt corn and soy in the U.S. and wheat in Russia and Ukraine and Kazakhstan. Use of corn in production of ethanol in the U.S., and I don't think that should be allowed.
I don't either.
Counting for up to 40% of corn crops has also been blamed for the price jump. But of course, this isn't the beginning of rising food prices. Costs have been going up for some time now. You can see a food price index. We covered around last Thanksgiving. You have to go to that. The food index count, which is an overall score reflecting the total price of the top six food commodities, rose to 215 in December of 2010, up from 90 in the year 2000. Sugar spearheaded the spike, hitting only 2 points away from the 400 mark in December of 2010. And we've come right to the end. Rice is the only staple that has actually decreased in price by 4%. I don't know why that is. And the G20 is unsympathetic to those in need.
Which is,
Yeah, no kidding.
So, anyway, we're not surprised at that. If you want to go to that article, go to the Activist Post and read Rising Food Prices Continue to Climb.
And that was published Sunday, September 9th, 2012. We want to thank you for being with us tonight, and we hope we've brought you some news that you haven't seen or haven't heard.
And
you can think about or maybe go to yourself and figure out some more
stuff. And mention that to your friends and your family and let them know what's going on. So I want to thank you and join us tomorrow night and we'll bring you more.
Bye.
Fascinating news.
But tomorrow we'll be focusing the first part of the show on union news.
On union issues, yeah.
And union issues, and the second part on.
And we'll be talking some about the strike in Chicago and a bunch of other things to it. So we'll talk more on that tomorrow. So we hope you join us then, and have a great evening, everybody.
Good night, folks.
Yeah.